Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm your pot scrubber, garde-manger, and saucy saucier, David Santo. And today we're just hanging out in the kitchen. Actually, we're talking about kitchens, kitchen design and its effects on the people we love, as well as the stories we tell about kitchens and the ways that kitchens enable us to tell stories and to dance and to love and, yeah, to cook and eat, too. To put us in the mood for all that, let us pause for a brief musical interlude. That was the sound of bodies moving in space, perhaps in elegant dresses, perhaps in grease-spattered aprons, maybe eyeing each other romantically, maybe stirring stew pots and chopping herbs. Less figuratively, it was Frédéric Chopin's Waltz in A minor, B150, written sometime between 1843 and 1848, and performed by pianist Aya Higuchi. For me, a waltz is an appropriate piece of music to imagine as guiding the choreography of my kitchen movements. But depending on how you interact with the architecture and surfaces and appliances in your own cooking spaces, maybe another genre is more appropriate. I can certainly imagine some folks wok-frying ginger beef to Dua Lipa or Jessie Ware, or maybe kneading sourdough while mumbling Leonard Cohen lyrics, or filleting a trout to a Carrie Underwood revenge tune. Maybe next time he'll think before he fries. Oh dear. Anyway, whatever your gastrophonic preferences, music in the kitchen kind of makes sense. Our kitchens are places of rhythm and emotion and connection making. They can be both harmonious and disharmonious, sometimes enabling brilliance, sometimes burnt mush. They ground us in the here and now of feeding hungry bodies, and they exalt us with flights of imagination and artistry. Just like performing music, performing food is both a representation of our collective culture and also the means by which we create culture. Music and food are always hybrids of innovation and tradition, evolving patterns and practices, never solely linked to just one place or time or people, and always bridging communities and histories. The history of kitchens is a nexus of technologies and gendered labor and logistics and inventory management, also design and family dynamics of gastronomy and power and wealth and poverty. They are often the warmest room in the house, a reason to gather in colder climates, and a motivator for maximizing air circulation in warm ones. The simplest kind of kitchen is maybe a fire pit and a stream, or maybe an ice house. The most complex kitchen is one that has to turn out thousands of meals a day, all made to order and very, very quickly. Or maybe it's the kitchen where family members have a hard time expressing their feelings. Anyway, like all food environments, kitchens are spaces of transformation, and not just of edible stuff. Outside of restaurants and homes, other kinds of kitchens serve other kinds of purposes. Office kitchens foment gossip and lateral communication. Drug kitchens beget crime and addiction and sometimes violent explosions. Community kitchens enable cost savings, cultural exchange, and social support networks. And the kitchens in our gurdwaras and synagogues and mosques facilitate food making for the ceremonies and celebrations that reinforce our sense of belonging and identity. What better places to spend our energy and attention, and maybe also a little podcasting time? Today's kitchen chat focuses on their design and their physical, material nature, but also on the ways that kitchens are symbolically represented, and sometimes not, in books and poems and short stories. To that end, I'm talking with a kitchen creator and a scholar of literature. Later, Maxime and I get a little spicy during the Stick This in Your Mouth segment, and closing the episode, you'll hear from an artist and interaction designer as she responds to the food questionnaire. I've also got a story of how Cher and a bit of Moonlight inspired one of the most memorable meal preparations I've ever had with my parents. First up, Hubert Taschereau, a kitchen designer, fabricator, and installer who also happens to live downstairs from me. Hubert founded and then sold a company called Geppetto, whose philosophy is to make simple kitchens that are nevertheless never banal. For him, kitchens help families, or whoever's in them, relate to and learn from each other. And yeah, judging from the sounds that occasionally rise up from the first floor, I'd say that his kitchen does just that. We recorded our conversation way back in December of 2022.
Hubert, tell me about Geppetto, this wonderful company of design and fabrication of kitchens that you founded.
Well, I've started Geppetto in 2009, and we've designed kitchens, and we worked for a lot of architectural firms from Montreal and helped build many projects over the years. So yeah, we focus mainly on designing stuff and also building for the architects. Often architects will come to us, they have a whole house, an idea for the whole house, and then we'll have to get into the details and make things more ergonomics or stuff like that.
So there's an aesthetic quality that you bring, but there's also a logistical aspect that
definitely
very practical.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because that's what a kitchen is, after all.
Yeah, definitely.
And so what do you think it is that makes for a really good kitchen?
It's going to be cliche, but you're in Quebec, like it's probably like that all over the world, but how we always end up in the kitchens. I think for me, it's being able to cook and having guests and just, you know, that there's a flow. It's about efficiency, but also about just being able to have a flow with the family or friends when you gather there.
Yeah, because I mean, a lot of the history of kitchen design, not just in Quebec, but throughout North America in industrialized countries, kitchen design has become very functional in many ways. And yet a kitchen is also the center of the house. It's the place where people gather and come together to be social.
Yeah.
So there's a balance that you need to create, yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
So thinking about how the physical environment affects the way that we interact socially.
Like any other room in the house, there's a lot of things like sunlight and stuff like this. You know, like how it's always preferable to have a sink facing a window to see outside. But yeah, you want something, in my opinion, something that's open, where you have enough storage. Open shelf is really nice, depending on your personality, I would say. If, like for me, I love it when I see it in a magazine, but it doesn't fit with the family dynamic. I would say a great design is probably what makes you feel good. And so one kitchen can be the best for someone and the worst for someone else.
You mentioned magazines, and I think that's one of the things that a lot of people in mediatized or industrialized countries who are exposed to food TV, exposed to design TV, if we have a lot of experience watching or seeing kitchen spaces in media, we tend to think, oh, that's a good kitchen. But what you're saying is really a good kitchen is the kitchen that works for the family.
Yeah, definitely. I think every time I see like a reality show or something and they build this beautiful open shelf, of course, every time I see it, I'm like, wow, that would work for me. But I know it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, and I think about like, I like having everything out. But at the same time, if you're cooking, if you're frying a steak at some point in your life,
yeah,
there's grease going
exactly
everywhere. The smells going everywhere. All the stuff that's all that, all the beautiful open exposed shelving is getting covered in whatever you're cooking.
Yeah, and so sometimes it's just preferable to have close the storage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So when you are working on a kitchen redesign,
yeah,
what are they looking to have you fix or change so that it works better?
It really depends. Like for architects, when there's an architect involved, often it's like a make. It's not just they'll take like a duplex and make a single home with it. So everything just moves. So the kitchen's not gonna stay the same place. So they're rethinking everything. Mm-hmm. But when someone approaches us to redo the kitchen, first thing is we look at the layout. We look with them, what do you like and what do you not like? And again, you know, sometimes people will say, well, we'd love an island, but sometimes you can't afford it in terms of space. A lot of times it starts with making it goût du jour,
mm-hmm,
which...
So like the flavor of the moment.
Yeah. So it doesn't always start with functionality. If someone likes the layout, okay, there's not much work. It is what it is, and they like it. But if they don't, it's fun to start playing around. Say, okay, what about the sink if we put it over there? And it can, the same room can give a totally different vibe once it's done. And sometimes you end up at the same place because it makes no sense. You can't do anything else.
So one of the aesthetic qualities of your work is simplicity without being banal or boring.
Yeah.
How do you achieve that balance between something that looks clean, but that is not stripped of personality?
Good question. What I do know is that for most of the project that we worked on, once it's installed, and I look at it, I always think how simplistic it is. But behind the scene, to get there, to have like a straight line across the room, it's really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
When we come to the technical drawings and stuff like that to build, it's really, really... So it's crazy how complicated it is to get something that when you look at it, it seems very simple. Just a couple panels and stuff like that, but it's not.
Well, and I imagine, but, particularly on an older building, making straight lines is nearly impossible because you're dealing with the old structure of the building, which may not be that carré, might not be that square, might not be that even, it might not be that level. So to make something look visually simple in a complicated space is a very complex process.
Yeah, and you have to look at the space and, you know, if there's a 2-inch slope on the ceiling and customers are not willing to fix it, you're not going to put a filler that goes from 0 to 2 inch. You're just going to lower everything to make sure that the eyes forget that there's this angle between your cabinet and the ceiling. So yeah, you do have to take this into account.
So does the sort of aesthetic quality or the thing that you work towards, is that your personal taste? Is that a mixture of your personal taste and your client's taste? Is it something about the bigger zeitgeist or trends that are going on in the world? How do you find the right thing, given all the different taste levels that might be present?
Well, I would say it's energy works in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that it's my taste, but you know, you tend to attract what you are, in a sense.
Right, right.
So at some point when you work with architectural firms, they come back to you. And so it's their taste, but we have this in common now. So if I design stuff for someone, then it's going to be in the vein of what I would do for another architect, because we cannot think alike.
So a client who doesn't like your aesthetic is never going to come and hire you.
I've had some people over the years who, you know, they look at the Instagram page and it's, you wonder why they would choose you. So normally people, you know, would be like delighted by what they see. So yeah, then they would be on the same page.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because there are so many influences on our collective taste in things like design or kitchen or architecture or kitchen arrangements. All of these things are influenced by what we see in the world, what we see in our friends' homes, what we grew up with, what we aspire to. And so you're kind of, not to make it too big, but you're sort of a therapist for domestic design to try to help people figure out through the process of designing their space what they actually want, what they actually hope for or thinking about.
Yeah, and the therapy goes beyond that in the sense that there's always like two person in a relationship. So you have to work in the middle, and sometimes it's really not clear what once, or sometimes it is clear, but they don't agree on the same thing. And when you don't agree, you cut it in the middle, but nobody's going to be happy. So yeah, there's a lot of therapy in there.
Well, I hope it's all positive therapy and doesn't end up in
almost
divorce court. You mentioned money. Money is always an issue, particularly in home renovation. What happens? What do you, if a client comes to you and says, I want to do this and this and this, but my budget is only half of what you think is realistic. How do you negotiate that or navigate the difference between the expectation and the budget that's available for the change that these people want to see in their home?
Well, Gepetto is not a place where we have different gam.
Different sort of levels.
We do high-end stuff. So it's understandable that people have a budget, of course. But if a budget is too low, sometimes it's better for them just to go somewhere else. And it's fine for us, fine for them. You know, like we'll work on projects where people will take storage from IKEA and the kitchen from us. And to me, it makes a lot of sense.
So you're perfectly open to figuring out the really economical version of the hardware, for example, and the more custom level of the surface.
Well, depending in the sense that we will not incorporate IKEA cabinet into what we do.
Okay.
But it can, you know, in a project where there's an architect involved or in a room, there can be storage that the contractor is going to assemble. And so, I'm not looking down.
And you're not trying to stay pure to some
definitely not. Because I do understand that at some point you have a budget and it's like these renovations can cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
So for many reasons, sometimes it can be you don't have the money to do this, or you know, you're there for a couple of years at a certain age when we're here for long run. So you want to go all in. But if not, yeah, we'll find, if it's within the budget that we feel makes sense, then yeah, we'll find ways to, you know, like a lot of, I'm not a fan of gadgets in kitchens, but there's a lot of different types of hardware that can be used. And I'm honestly just a fan of doors and drawers. And even like even big pullouts, like pantry and stuff like that, I'm more a fan of a just simple door with wooden drawers inside. And it's simple and it works.
So speaking of gadgets, what do you think of what seems like the coming wave of smart appliances or refrigerators that are attached to Wi-Fi or stoves that you can pre-program?
Like anything, I mean, I always try to be careful because I don't want to sound like our parents may have sounded at some point. You know, we move forward in life. But again, I'm a very simple guy in my life and my phone probably brought me a lot. But we're always messing around trying to, okay, what's the Wi-Fi? Why am I not connected? You know, we had a robot vacuum at some point and didn't work with the dynamic with the kids, but I still feel like a good old vacuum or a broom works very well. And so, yeah, so it's a lot of gadgets and I don't want to be against technology, but I don't want to on my phone start the oven before I get home. I know that there's a lot of good to that. But yeah, whether my opinion is good or not about this, it's not going to stop for sure.
Well, you know, we can offer our ideas and hope that the world listens, and we can also just keep on doing what we have always been doing ourselves. So tell me about your own kitchen. Like, did you design your own kitchen?
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
And is it the space that you think is perfect, or there's always something else to think about?
I think, again, it's within a certain context. I think it's perfect in what we wanted to achieve, in a sense that it's a small kitchen. We didn't want to tear down walls and start a big renovations, so we kept mostly everything in place. But so it's very small. We have two kids. You know, they want to help in the kitchen. But if we would have chosen another direction or something, an island would have been super nice. Yeah. Again, as I said before, just being able to cook with the kids without them being in the way and being next to you. You know, you can give them stuff to do or something.
Yeah.
It would have been nice.
And as our families evolve and change and grow and become larger, in terms of the kids anyway, kitchens need to evolve too. So maybe you'll become your own client in the future and
definitely.
Do a redesign you need to adapt to what the kids are doing when they're 8 and 12.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe take one of their rooms.
Yeah. Sorry, kid, you don't have a playroom anymore, but it's becoming part of the kitchen.
Yeah, you see with your sister now.
This has been a wonderful, insightful conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, David.
My next guest is Alexia Moyer. Alexia is a writer and editor, a translator, and a doctor of literature. She runs an editorial collective called Redline Ligne Rouge, manages a journal called Canadian Food Studies, La Revue Canadienne des Études sur l'Alimentation, and she spends much of her free time trying to devise ways of getting her kids to eat mushrooms and parsnips. As she says, success is just within reach. I'm also an optimist. Thank you, first of all, very much for coming on the podcast. I'm delighted to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I just wanted to talk to you about kitchens because I won't even guess how many years ago it was, but many years ago, I heard you talk about a bunch of examples from food literature in which authors talked about a kind of what you named as a kitchen choreography, or they named as a kitchen choreography. And I love that image. I love the way it made the kitchen into a kind of space of dance or performance. And I just wonder if you'd tell me more about that literature that you are so well versed in, that in which kitchens become a kind of performance space through choreography or other movement.
Sure. When I'm thinking about kitchens as a space of performance, I'm thinking about performance as accomplishing a task or carrying out a function rather than entertainment. I'm thinking in terms of gesture sequences that have rhythm, that are repeated, such that they become automatic, so that one develops muscle memory. So let's say you're making a vinaigrette and you know that it's, well, in French cooking, it's one part vinegar, three parts oil. If you whisk it enough with mustard, it will emulsify. And that movement of the spoon in the bowl, that wrist action becomes muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And this idea for me comes from two sources. The first one is Michel de Certeau and Pierre Mayol and Lucie Arce, The Practice of Everyday Life.
Right. And these are some of the great sort of sociologist thinkers about how food was something to be observed in its daily domestic practices. Yeah. Not cuisine so much as the ins and outs of what you're describing, that is movements and things happening in kitchens.
Exactly. And there's this wonderful chapter by Luc Chirat called Doing Cooking, which is the English translation of Faire la Cuisine. And she's talking about this idea of entraînement physique, the physical training that is required in the kitchen. And to prepare a meal is to put together a series of gesture sequences. But the idea for me also comes from ballet, because I was a dancer for many years. And so I was schooled in memorizing movement patterns. A grand jeté and classical ballets are most often preceded by a coupé chassé, pas de bourrée, glissade. My body can do it more quickly than I can say it, even 20 years later. And so, this idea comes from these two sources. And there are a lot of writers, and I think of Fred Waugh, the poet, whose book Diamond Grill, which is a series of prose poems, he really captures this rhythm of working in the kitchen quite beautifully.
And in fact, even my favorite philosopher of food, Lisa Helke, who's been on the show, has talked about the sort of the gesture of making bread, that rhythm, that interaction between the bread dough, the surface of the counter, your hands, the humidity in the air, the humidity on your hand. And that there's this kind of, it is a dance, that there's this sense of movement that gets inscribed into your body, that becomes normalized, that becomes a habit. And we just think of, oh, I know how to make bread, but it's also, as you call it, muscle memory or dance with a sequence in it that has repeated gestures. And because we repeat them over and over again, when we make bread, we get into this feeling, and it's there. It's real, even though you can't sort of identify it scientifically.
Yes. And it's hard to trace the learning process in a way that you can more quickly from books. And that's something that Lucia writes about as somebody who wanted to learn to cook from books and then realizing that she had already picked up so much just from watching in the kitchen. So she recognized sounds that she should be listening for, movements that she should be making.
If you're in a kitchen that you're very familiar with or that you've cooked in many, many times, you know it as well as an actor or a dancer knows the stage. You know exactly where all the props are or the corners are that you want to avoid as you're spinning in your circles and your pirouettes and your grand jeté around the room. It's you feel it. It's a relationship.
Yes. Actually, there's a really great movie about this, and I'm trying to remember the title. I don't know if it's called Kitchen Stories, in which they study that triangle in the kitchen and the way people move in the kitchen.
Yeah, that's a fabulous movie. And it's about these like Swedish scientists who go and investigate Norwegian single men's homes. And they discovered that the kitchen choreography is not scientizable.
Exactly. It's a marvelous film. So.
It's a beautiful movie, yeah. So obviously you have experience with a great range of literature that covers food related subjects, but a lot of authors, fiction authors I'm thinking of who just don't really address what happens in kitchens. They glide over it. So some authors focus on kitchens, some authors don't focus on kitchens. And it seems to me that's sort of bizarrely contradictory. Do you have a sense of why that is, that in some forms of literature, food and kitchens and cooking become very visible, and in some others, they're just sort of ignored?
So I think even more broadly than kitchens themselves, there are writers that write about food and writers that don't. And I was looking at this anthology of writing that was written in 1987, that was edited in 1987 by Margaret Atwood. It's called The Candlelit Food Book. And she put it together as a fundraiser for Penn International. And as she was collecting the materials, she really saw this dichotomy between the food and the not food interests. And she always wondered as a child, when she was reading Ivanhoe, what Rebecca was able to eat when she was shut up in the tower. Poor thing. But I think the thing that we need to keep in mind is that when an author feeds a character or places them in a kitchen, that choice is always deliberate. It always has meaning. So unlike us, we need to eat to survive, but a character doesn't necessarily need to eat. So when you see a food scene, it has meaning. And Rachel McGee writes that it gives readers a sense of their characters, their world, and their relationship to that world.
It's kind of an embedding process in the lived experience of the humanness of the character and not necessarily the intellectual experience or the emotional experience that the author might be wanting to convey in some sort of disembodied, non-eating character's life.
Yeah, exactly. And if they're not eating, there may be a reason for that as well.
Right, of course. Well, and I'm sort of also assuming that from a sort of long systemic sexism perspective, since food work and other forms of domestic labor were historically associated with women's roles in the household and women's roles have often been devalued, that food scenes or kitchen work or these kinds of things would also not necessarily valued by all masculocentric authors throughout the history of literature.
Yes, and it's also something that writers and editors have expressed their ambivalence about using this space and writing about this space. So there's another anthology of writing by Edna Alford and Claire Harris of Canadian writing, and it's called Kitchen Talk. And Edna Alford talks about her reluctance initially to enter into this project because the kitchen is a challenging space. It's a space of captivity as well as a space of creativity. And she wasn't sure how best to kind of approach the subject. But she was, even though she was worried that there was a considerable lack of material on this subject, she actually was surprised to find that there's so much writing on kitchens and women within that space. And she talks about, I'll just read here, that there were back kitchens and summer kitchens, camp kitchens, open air kitchens, the kitchens of the wealthy, the middle class, the impoverished, the kitchens of those in bondage and those who are free. There were restaurant kitchens, communal kitchens, tropical kitchens, Arctic kitchens, and all of them sites of significant human experience, celebration, damnation, and everything in between.
That's fabulous. What's that from again?
So this is Kitchen Talk.
I remember seeing that book on a shelf somewhere back in my history, but it's a beautiful expression of how kitchens are everywhere. Kitchens are just are spaces of creation. Kitchens, as you say, also spaces of in some cases isolation. Depending on the architecture of the kitchen, it might be more or less open to a house, but it's also a place where very often people work on their own in silence or in solitude in some ways, because often in a family or in a household, one person gets designated as the cook and everybody else gets the benefits of that, but they don't have to spend time in the kitchen. Although, of course, more and more these days, many more people participate in kitchen work.
That's interesting what you say about architecture playing a role in kitchen work and how it feels in the kitchen. I should specify that I live in the main floor apartment of a triplex that was built in 1929. So where the kitchen is placed in my apartment says a lot about the feelings about kitchen work in 1929. Mm-hmm. So it's at the back of the house. It is separated from the rest of the apartment with a door. And there's a sense of isolation, of wanting to keep the kitchen smells away from the public spaces.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, and kitchens are way before, say, the 20th century. Kitchens, yeah, they were smelly, they were messy, there were spaces where food had to come in and out. So often there was a service door or a backspace, a coal entry. Like there's a lot of mess that happens in kitchens. And if you had, let's put it in big air quotes, polite activities happening at the front of the house, you want to keep it isolated. But of course, now everything's very different in that regard. And kitchens often become show places, show pieces for the house. Even though people often don't use them very much, they spend a lot of money renovating them and then just show them off and then order in food. Kitchens are such weird spaces over the history of humanity.
We've sort of remedied that by ignoring our living room, which is at the front of the house, and simply living in the kitchen at the back of the house. Although I do have to go into the living room eventually because that's where all the books are.
So for this conversation, you've situated yourself at the front of the house.
Yes.
The space of intellectual activity and not messy, greasy food making. So what in your experience with literature, and particularly with literature in which kitchens and food shows up, what are some of your favorite portrayals of kitchens, ones that appeal to you particularly?
I've selected three for you, three different categories. And one goes back to this idea of the rhythm of work, and it's by Fredois. And I'll just read a passage for you. Hands on the move, and with one of them break an egg into the coffee grounds, turn taps, fill cream, jugs, body picks up speed, a little spark to the step starts. This is work, rhythm. Don't love it, but count on it. Get into it, some kind of dance, pattern, yet yielding at the edges, room for subtle improv. So this is this idea of the rhythm of work. But I've also selected one that talks about the fact that kitchen spaces are multifunctional. So they're not just for cooking. And this comes from this other anthology, Kitchen Talk, because there's this wonderful series throughout by the poet Inga Israel. And she approached a number of women from Russia, from the Ukraine, from Germany, and who came to Canada in the early to mid 20th century. And these are testimonies about their lives in kitchens, their former lives in kitchens and their current lives in kitchens. And so this one is from a Mrs. R. from Alberta, who was born in 1912. And she writes, "The kitchen was the main part of the house. It's where we did everything. My mother's sewing machine was there. She used to make shirts out of old horse blankets. And when the shirts had to be washed, whoever had been wearing them had to go to bed until they were dry again. There weren't any others to change into. She did all the washing in the kitchen. We'd carry in the pails of water and she'd boil it and then use a board to scrub the clothes clean. We had our baths right there in the kitchen too, one after the other. And several of us had to use the same water. If someone came into the kitchen, my mother made us duck down into the water."
Oh, that's fabulous.
And so I like that because that is what our kitchen represents to us as a family. It's that space where everything happens. But it also gives you a glimpse into past lives in these kitchen spaces.
Yeah. Well, and it echoes of Kitchen Stories, the movie that we were just talking about, in which the bathtub is centered, is right there in the kitchen, along with all the other activities that happen. You know, space that's warm. Unsurprisingly, kitchens were often gathering spaces just because they were the warmest room in the house. And they still seem to be the place where resources are, whether they're edible or emotional.
And that takes me to my next one, which is I like these passages where there is very little that is said, and yet so much is said with little to go on. And so I'll give you another example from Inga Israel's series. This is from Mrs. B. from Germany. And she was born in 1908 and came to Canada in 1957. And so she is asked the question of her memories of what happened in those kitchens. And she actually describes life during both world wars and only gets to kitchens at the very end. And she says, "But in the kitchen, well, there were pots and pans. And if there was food, we cooked it."
Wow.
And so that if says so much about life at that time in Germany.
Yeah. No, it's a good reminder that not everybody's kitchen, even today, is full of food, and not everybody's kitchen is a space of warmth and happiness. It's often a very fraught space.
Yes, and this is something that that Natalie Cook and Shelley Boyd talk about in their new book, Canadian Literary Fare. Something that they discovered in studying food in Canadian literature is that it's not so much celebratory as it is talking about lack, moments of difficulty, as opposed to what we see in cookbooks that are produced that talk about Canadian food and Canadian food traditions, which are laudatory.
Of course, to sell commercial cookbooks, you want to make it all celebratory, joyous, luscious, delicious, beautiful, all the stuff. And yet, of course, that's not the reality for many people. And then maybe in literature, where just being joyous doesn't make for such an interesting read. Like, some of the more difficult emotions that are associated with food actually make for really good written fare.
Yeah.
What does your own kitchen evoke for you in terms of literature? I mean, you said it's the multifunction space of the house. It's where you tend to live and assemble. But when you go in there, do you feel like, oh, I'm in a poem, or oh, I'm in a haiku, or wow, I'm in an epic saga that needs to be written by Homer? Or is there something else? Or none of that, because this is your work and that's your kitchen?
Well, we did renovate the space recently, and people were more qualified than me, removed all the upper cabinets, and which means that there's less storage. But it's a very quiet space because there's just the lower cabinets and a lot of workspace, and it's a very meditative space. It's also the space in which I have cooked a lot of meals from Canadian literature. So in working with Natalie Cook and Shelley Boyd many years ago, we would cook meals from Canadian literary texts and then photograph the results and then talk about these particular scenes. And so my memories of making pasta from the poet Carmine Starnino or making Fredois beef tomato or tomato beef, making dozens and dozens and dozens of recipes from Canadian literature. So in that sense, and these are meals that I make regularly. So in that sense, I'm making a poem or I'm making a prose poem.
Yeah, and you're participating in Canadian literature in deep and interesting ways.
Yes, and really at the cellular level, I'm ingesting it literally.
So I wish we could talk about this forever. I love your perspectives on kitchens and on food and on pretty well everything. But it's been really a pleasure to hear you talk about it and share your own experiences in your own kitchen.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a delight to be part of this podcast.
Thank you. And the readings that Alexia referred to, as well as the film Kitchen Stories that we both mentioned, check out the show notes for this episode. And if you know of a great piece of food literature that exalts kitchens and cooking choreographies, send me a message via social media. I'm always looking for a tasty read. Well, welcome back to another edition of Stick This in Your Mouth, except this time we're not sticking things in our mouths, Maxime.
What are we doing?
Well, do you have any other holes we could stick things in?
Yes, David.
Okay. Well, I was thinking about our nostrils because we're going to play around with smell this time instead of taste, because you're also extremely sensitive, I find, when it comes to smelling things. And you smell floral smells and spicy smells and food smells much more than I do. So I thought, let's try that out.
Mm-hmm.
Are you excited?
I am, especially, and you have to tell the listener that I've taken off my glasses and I'm almost blind. So. Oh. This will be a almost blind smell test.
So we're blocking one of your senses to see whether it has an effect on the other sense. But it's interesting to think about smells and memory, smells mm-hmm. and taste, because of course taste is not just what happens in our mouth, but happens in our whole olfactory yes. system. And so this is one component of tasting.
Yes, very well. Let's start the adventure.
Okay, so with Maxime's, with his eyes mostly shut, but also with no glasses on, I'm going to open up some different jars from our mm-hmm. kitchen spice rack and see what you think. Let's start with this one. Okay. Ooh, I can smell already. So tell me what you smell.
That's anise étoilé in French and
star anise. Yes. Star anise,
which is such a sumptuous smell.
Sumptuous in what way?
The meals that you make with star anise are very flavorful. I'm thinking about Indian food. I'm thinking about all those wonderful, saucy, smelly dishes from these parts of the world.
Yeah, I think I always think about things like braised lamb shanks.
Yes.
Like that. But so really, it's a deep smell.
It's kind of fruity, but has a very, very special taste.
Yeah, no, it's very distinctive. I used to hate star anise and have come to appreciate it.
Why did you?
I don't know. I just always found it very too pungent, too strong, often used badly, I think.
But mm-hmm.
Okay, well, cool. Let's move on to the next one. What do you smell when you stick this in your nose?
Oh, my. Is that...
You opened your eyes.
I opened my eyes. I have cheated, listeners. It's cumin.
It's cumin. You know it so well. Yes. We know it so well. We use it in everything. But it's also oddly hard to pinpoint.
Yes. I was a little stumped.
Yeah. So that's the Ras Al Hanout, which I think probably has some cumin in it. It's kind of a Middle Eastern.
It's like a masala. Curry or masala.
Mm. Mm. Because Ras Al Hanout I only found in your cupboard shelf the first time.
Yes, and this is a fairly new add-on to my repertoire. Once again, very distinctive taste. Just very, very fragrant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's so many different things, I think, combined together that it just elevates things. And it also deepens things. I find it has a very... This is one of the weird things about the smell. We have a really minimal vocabulary for describing...
Yes.
What, like, is it a high note, a low note? Like, perfumers have developed this whole vocabulary, but it's not really... doesn't translate into cooking so well, the perfumery language. Mm-hmm. It's still not as clear cut as our tasting language.
Mm-hmm. What's next on the smell horizon?
Well, on the smell horizon, here's one that's a little bit more classical in our culinary traditions. Maybe this is a European masala in some way.
Yes, that's Herbe de Provence.
Yes, Herbe de Provence. So it's a blend of, multiple things.
Yeah.
What is an Herbe de Provence? I don't even know.
Herbe de Provence is... oh my God. What?
Thyme?
I'm stumped.
Thyme?
I'm thyme. Oregano, basil? Thyme, oregano. I don't know that basil. Romare.
Rosemary.
Rosemary. And a couple...
It's so funny. I don't think I've ever...
I don't know that...
Learned.
That...
It's not on the package.
Oh, it's not on the package label. Oh my God.
We're screwed. Some listener will write to us and say, you're idiots.
Yes, we are listeners. You don't know.
It's funny because it used to be like the most important herb in North American cuisine. I mean, I'm making that up.
Well, for a while, when I first started cooking, I would put it in everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it was just like, it was a staple in my mom's cupboard. So I...
Yeah. Now we use rest of honey in everything.
Yes.
Okay. One more spice. See what you think.
Ooh. Nutmeg. No, that's clove.
Yes.
Clou de girofle. Yes.
What does that make you think of?
That makes me think of Christmas.
Yeah. A little bit too much sometimes.
Sometimes, yes.
When it's what we call sort of a sweet spice, it's often in sweet dishes. But there's also like in Quebecois cuisine, we also have like an unusual number of sweet spices that are used. This is what always astounded me about Quebecois cuisine is spaghetti sauce, often made with cinnamon.
That is very true.
And it's so distinctive. I don't think I've ever had that anywhere else, but like a perfectly straightforward, savory tomato and meat sauce made with cinnamon.
Yeah.
And it's kind of wonderful.
Yeah.
It can also be overdone. Okay, last smell for you. Mm-hmm. I think you've seen it already. It's a vanilla bean.
Oh.
So just smell that, because I know you love vanilla.
Oh. Mm. I love it so much. I would marry. I love it so much. I would want to marry it. I love vanilla. Like I have perfumes that have are vanilla based. It's just a yummy, yummy, yummy smell. It reminds me of pastries, I think, first and foremost. But like, it brings a smile to my face. It also evokes happy memories of coming home and like smelling a baking cake. It's a fun food to play around, especially if you use the whole bean.
Yeah. So vanilla and caramel are the two most popular tastes globally, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very related in many ways. That sort of sweet warmth that is, as I understand it, a very strong memory for most people who were breastfed, because the smell of mother's milk is very vanilla. Kind of vanilla caramel, and that's why it becomes a very internationally favorite aroma, because it connects us to this, apparently this memory, if we were breastfed.
Make a lot of sense. Yeah. I mean, I think even baby formula, it smells a little bit like this also.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for letting me stick so many things in your nose.
You're welcome.
You were going to have to get a Kleenex to wipe off your nostril rings, because they're looking a little covered in powder, and we don't want anybody to think you've been doing something inappropriate.
No. Never. I never do anything inappropriate.
No. All right. Thanks, Maxine.
Au revoir.
Bye.
Bye.
The nearly perfect food movie, Babette's Feast, has long inspired me about what kitchens can do, not just to food, but to the people who work in them. In this film, based on the short story by Isaac Dinesen, the Parisian cook Babette has come to the northern coast of Denmark in the late 1800s to find refuge from the Franco-Prussian War. She's taken in by a pair of kindly yet ascetic sisters, the daughters of a now dead religious leader and the quasi-leaders of their dwindling Protestant sect.
After many years with them, Babette suddenly comes into a very large sum of money and decides to create un vrai dîner français, a real French dinner, for the sisters and for their community. It's a gesture of incredible gratitude for their kindness and hospitality, but it's also a way for Babette to regain a sense of her own past identity as an artist, an artisan, a creator, a Frenchwoman, and a chef. So, towards the end of the film, as Babette is creating her dîner français in this incredibly humble, wood-fired, low-ceilinged country kitchen, we see what happens to a person who is in deep relationship with such domains. Babette comes to life through her movements, glowing, not just because of the heat and the flames, but because she is wielding her skills so capably and after such a long time. She makes turtle soup and blini demi-d'œuf, quails in puff pastry shells and a baba au rhum. She serves Amontillado sherry and Veuve Clicquot champagne, a Clos de Vougeot pinot noir, a Sauternes, and some very fine cognac. She is, as M.F.K. Fisher once wrote about herself, at the full measure of her powers. Babette has regained what she was prior to becoming a war refugee. Food and cooking does that, and not just in film and fiction. In my own life, I recall a variation of Babette's experience. It was in Montreal, in the kitchen of the last house that my parents owned there. I was about 20 years old, I think. The three of us had just come back from a late afternoon screening of Moonstruck, that wonderful film with Cher and Nicolas Cage and Olympia Dukakis. It's about love and hope and enchantment. Anyway, we got home, and we were hungry, and there wasn't much in the fridge. We were all a little high from the joy of the film, and particularly the way the characters celebrated moments with glasses of champagne into which they dropped a sugar lump. It's very dramatic and overflowing with fun. So we found a single pork chop in the fridge, and an onion, and I think some dried up cooked rice. We also discovered that we had one of those little teeny-weeny mini bottles of Henkeltrucken, the German sparkling wine. It was enough for about a glass and a quarter, maybe. So I went and got a single champagne flute from the dining room cabinet. My father put on an opera recording on our old record player. We shared the glass of Henkel and fried the pork chop. We warmed up the rice and I made some sort of onion marmalade with poppy seeds. And to the sounds of the opera singers, the three of us glided back and forth in our kitchen, carrying out our various tasks. The space was perfect for us. We had collectively designed it when the house was renovated, specifically so that the three of us could easily cook together without bumping into things or bumping into each other. So when we sat down on the stools around the central kitchen counter, the wine was gone, but the music played on, and we ate the small pork chop, sliced ever so thinly by my mother, with the onions and with the rice. There was probably some rye bread and butter, too. There was always rye bread and butter. I always think about that evening as a kind of perfect kitchen dance for three. We were seamless, just exultant and fluid and happy. We were, I now think, at the full measure of our powers. As usual, it's time for the Making a Meal of It food questionnaire. This week's respondent is Dawn Lee, a person I have known for about 35 years. She's a designer and an artist and a quilter and a cook, and we have spent many, many gorgeous hours in her and my kitchens. And she is the only person I've ever known who can make beef Wellington and Chinese wax sausage rolls with equal aplomb. She's a wonderful friend, a teacher, an ally, and when I lived in Toronto, she showed me how to do ikebana and order dim sum in Chinese. The little ladies from Hong Kong who pushed the steam carts around always did a double take when I got something right, and Dawn always laughed with deep pleasure at that. For nearly four decades, Dawn Lee has been a designer for the Ontario Science Centre in Toronto. She's a trained artist and animator, a muralist, and a community activist. As we recorded her responses, Dawn described herself as nervous, hungry, and thinking about lunch. Dawn, what is your idea of a perfect food?
Cantonese cuisine.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
Food that's unfamiliar and strange to me.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
A diabetic diet. I had meant it to be a diabetic diet, but then I wrote diabetic diet. So I kind of like that.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Too tasty.
Which food person do you most admire?
A good Chinese chef who can also create good dim sum.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Fancy mixed alcoholic drinks.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
A fresh lobster roll eaten on the East Coast.
For what do you hunger?
Braised ginger and onion oysters in a hot pot.
What do you consider to be an overrated food or food context?
High tea.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
A fancy seder with gefilte fish.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
Not big enough to hold all the friends I want to invite.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
The natural juiciness.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
Soft, rare, cuts like butter.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Hot sauce.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
Natural gardens that doesn't require me to work, but let me sit still and enjoy its life-giving force.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
The balance of salt, sugar, and fat being essential to good nutrition.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
I have so many I can't remember.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would it be?
A sweet, ripe, juicy watermelon.
Where and or when would you most like to dine?
A quiet hole-in-the-wall, peaceful diner with a picturesque window.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
My Nespresso coffee maker.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Chinese preserved duck liver sausage.
What is your favorite aroma?
First cup of coffee in the morning.
What do you most value in your friend's food?
Made with love and care.
Who are your favorite food writers?
I don't read.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
Glenn and friends.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
Cantonese.
What would you eat as your second to last meal?
I can only decide at that moment what I feel like.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
Dawn, art, food, and friends.
What question would you either add to this questionnaire or like to ask me?
How do you want to change the world with food?
And we're done with this episode of Making a Meal of It. Thank you so much to Hubert Tachereau, Alexia Moyer, Don Lee, and of course my spice-sniffing dance partner Maxime Giroux. My deepest gratitude to the myriad kitchen goddesses and oven elves who have helped me sense, feel, and vibe with the cooking spaces in which I have moved. And of course to those wonderful designers and writers who help us see and think about our kitchens anew. Check out the Making a Meal of It Instagram for photos of some of the kitchens I have worked in the past, and share an image or two of your own ones, or maybe a comment about what makes them special places for you. Next week, it's time to lift our glasses and let the fruit of the vine intoxicate us. Booze, alcohol, cocktails, wine, it's time for a drink, I think. And also to wonder about the ways in which ethanol, taken in moderation, of course, can help ground us in our bodies and elevate our imaginations. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, Kali Orexi and Tan Hai Aroena.